Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So, continuing my coverage from Augmented World Expo 2026, today's episode is with Christopher Stapleton, who has all sorts of different interesting frameworks around both XR as well as immersive storytelling. And yeah, it's just really interesting history through theme park design and XR and storytelling. And so, yeah, just really interesting to kind of hear some of his different reflections of his various different frameworks. And so I had previously met and worked with Christopher Stapleton way back in the day when he was still at the Virtual World Society. Virtual World Society is actually one of the very first sponsors of the Voices of VR podcast back in the day. And so I was working with Chris to kind of like get that set up. And yeah, it was a real privilege to be able to sit down with him just to hear a little bit more about some of his ideas and his frameworks. And I saw some of his slides that he was putting together for his talk from AWE, and they were absolutely like incredible and vast and lots of different information. Yeah, just really excited to be able to sit down with him and talk more around all these different aspects of immersive storytelling. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Christopher happened on Tuesday, June 16th, 2026 at the Augmented World Expo in Long Beach, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
I'm Christopher Stapleton, and I'm pioneering of XR, AR, VR, all those things. Last year, I won the IEEE Test of Time Award for Mixed Reality and Entertainment, Education, and Training for work I did 20 years ago. So I came back to see, oh, well, if it's still relevant today, I want to see where the industry is and how to apply it, because I just am coming back out of a little, what do you call it, a sabbatical.
Nice. And so maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Yeah, I studied design for stage and screen at NYU Tisch School of the Arts, started on Broadway and feature films, graduated with Spike Lee, and never touched a computer. And then after graduation, my first full-time job was all computers, because the guys basically saw that it's easier to teach an artist programming than a programmer art. So I was lucky enough to get swept up in that world that I ended up being ahead of the time of the industry, whatever I was working in, because artists back in the 80s didn't use computers.
And so what kind of work were you doing? I'm just trying to get a sense of your kind of professional journey or career, what kind of jobs and things you were doing with XR and how you're integrating into that.
Well, it started with doing cinema and theater in New York, and at the same time having a day job working with the evolving interactive computer graphics for IBM. And so that was kind of working between the both. And that started seeing the tools with three dimensions and virtuality. And then I started getting into theme parks and starting to mix the media virtual cinema with the theater techniques, which was kind of a form of a spatial AR. I did a spatial AR project for Rear Window for Universal Studios at the Hitchcock Pavilion. And so that was before they started using AR. But then early 90s, I started working with the UCF Institute for Simulation and Training, and they were doing all this very primitive VR. And I was from the theater and theme park background, and I just started sharing with them kind of an artistic way of seeing immersive worlds and designing them and looking at ways to develop story within their scenarios.
Nice. And so a big thing that I see around XR is that it's a bit of an interdisciplinary fusion of all these different design disciplines, from like game design and architecture, theater and dance, and your body, your sensory experience. You also have literature and ways that you have social dynamics that are group experiences. And then you have the cinematic tradition of film and music and lighting. And so you have all these different traditions that are all being fused together. And so I'm just curious, from your perspective, coming from that, you know, theater and arts and cinema background, how you start to conceive of what's happening when you look at the combination and interdisciplinary fusion of all these different disciplines.
Well, I started working with Universal Studios when they were first surging in the theme park industry. And that's what was so exciting. It combined my cinema, theater, storytelling background, as well as architecture. So I had all of the 90s to deal with that merging. But then I saw, you know, what's the outcome of all that? I've been spending hundreds of millions of dollars on having people pass time for entertainment. I mean, can I do something more than achieving entertainment. So I started my laboratory at UCF called the Media Convergence Laboratory. That's where I started to work with this transdisciplinary research, where you kind of start getting into other people's problem space. Only certain people can do that, particularly on a campus. But I was able to find the right people to collaborate with. And that really, the university got me an international collaboration across campuses, because I really wanted to start to move from the commercial to the academic. And then at the time, really what problems they were looking at, I started working with the civic sector, and they had some really good problems. So working in the space of civic, commercial, and academic really got me some good projects to experiment and produce results and outcomes. And that really challenged, I started working with Canon and their mixed reality pass-through goggles in the year 2000. And we started to just apply it everywhere. And it was just following a lot of different instincts, got into mixed reality very early on.
Yeah, in terms of different frameworks or ways of understanding the types of stories, or there's like game design frameworks, there's storytelling, screenwriting frameworks, or Aristotle, the three-act structure. So how do you start to conceive of what happens when you combine all these different disciplines and story, and the ways that you think about like what's the next phase of storytelling as you combine all these things together?
Yeah, well, the one thing I've done with the mixed reality world is really bring, it's not just real or virtual. There's a whole third world, which is the imagination, or imaginality versus reality. And that is really driven, you paint with the imagination in theme parks with story, play, and game, which are all entertainment, all interrelated, but the industries tend to separate the film industry and the game industry and the play industry. And once I started getting into research and designing experience in a virtual world, I realized how they related together. And I started to develop their own instructional strategy called interplay, which is the interplay of story, play, and game, where the story answers the question, why should I care? The play answers the question, what do I do? And the game mechanics answer the question, how does it work? How do I advance in this? And that why, what, and how really kind of is the breakdown of how design the experiences. And those work with different cognitive biological functions, as well as different techniques of story playing game, which are not really in their entertainment industries now, but that's how their brain works. And so working with cognitive scientists, neuroscientists, therapists, I could start to realize that story playing game are not just entertainment, they're how our brain works. And so everything that we know is attached to a story. And that's where the scientists are proving in brain research that's true. Now, as an artist, you know, the scientists end up proving what artists already know. So, you know, they, you know, that's a bad statement, but, you know, it tends to be true because we don't spend all the time on evidence-based data. So all of it was one to me from the very beginning, because I was, as a child, loving lucid dreaming and being able to kind of know that I'm in a dream and do what I want and make choices there. And that's what I've been doing since a child, is trying to figure out how can I experience my dreams in the conscious state of mind. So I've been going to every discipline, every practical application, and finding out what I could learn from each one.
Yeah, brilliant. The same things that you've been looking at are things that I've also been very drawn to, what's happening on the location-based entertainment, but specifically immersive storytelling and ways that people are using these technologies to tell stories in brand new ways. And story living is a word that's been thrown out there. I refer to it often as immersive storytelling. You tell me a phrase or a combination of words that you have your own way of describing all these things coming together. What was that again that you called it?
It's a number of different ones. There's the embodied conversational story creation. There's also the phygital interspace. There's also different forms of the interplay strategy of story playing game. So all of these are kind of paradigms or taxonomies that I use to teach with and design with to figure out what are the client's objectives and what are we starting with. I was working with Technicolor in their last year of existence. Really kind of interesting observation. I was the executive creative strategist for them. I was basically telling them that they got to radically innovate or die. And they took my advice, but made the wrong choice. They died. But, you know, they were looking at it from a CEO point of view that was from the car industry, not from the media industry. And people don't understand this difference between technology and media. I mean, all media is technology, even language is an ancient, but being able to transition a technology to a media, that purpose has to override the function. And from the user point of view, it becomes transparent. And that's what I usually work on, is I work with a lot of different companies like Canon, Vive, IBM, and Universal Disney to really take what their latest technology is and then adapt it to an application, find their solution that's looking for a problem that then I can process what that needs assessment is and really kind of artistically transform that technology into a form of media.
Can you say the one that, again, the embodied conversational, what was that one again?
The embodied conversational story creation.
Okay. Yeah. So
it's packed.
Yeah. Maybe you can unpack that in terms of how do you start to see all those things coming together?
My dear friend, Rick Stone, wrote a book called Story Intelligence. He has 7 powers of story: to transport, to transform, to unite, to enable learning, to create meaning, to, I mean, all these different things. And it's true, but really kind of how do you do that? And so I've been taking that framework and really bringing it into the experiential aspect. So first of all, story transcends media. Storytelling depends upon media. And to understand that difference, when you start to look at the emerging conventions of mixed reality, we have to really not see the new technology in the old ways, which we always do. And we all fumble until it is discovered. But you really need a live audience to really kind of give you feedback to understand how that media merges. And so with me, it's a conversation. So you need to really have that conversational aspect of the story, which I've been working with therapy and story therapy. But also with VR, it's embodied. It's all senses, all dimensions, all directions, all realities as one world driven by the imagination. And that's complicated pieces there. And so where that works is you start bringing the audience into being a participant. So the participant is starting to do some of the authoring. They aren't replace the author, but also you have the agency, which is usually the actor's point of view. And that is starting to mix. So the author is getting into other people's agents or acting and absorbing. And every form of story, whether it's RPG, video games, participatory theater, theme park, cinema, they all have a place in that realm that we can learn from to understand the common denominator to really reform the future conventions.
Nice. Yeah, there's quite a lot of overlap with that framework with my own elemental theory of presence. I'd love to dig into, but before I do that, have you published this or have you written about this embodied conversational story creation?
Yeah. And of course that makes the audience the creator. They have to be not just consumers. I've written a lot about it over the years and there are pieces all over the place. I've been thinking about, you know, bringing it all together, but it's advancing with the industry also. So with just getting recognized for my work 20 years ago from IEEE, you're like, oh, well, maybe what I was talking about, no one really understood, but now they could. But then I would have to put it in the frame of work. So I'm hoping my current project, is really going to help put it all to a case study to really kind of break it out and bring it into a mainstream application.
Yeah, I'd love to take a look at, maybe after this interview, pass along anything you've already written, and I'd love to take a look at other things, because as I've been using the elements as an inspiration, the earth element being embodied in environmental presence, so all the ways that you look at theater, architecture, dance, the body, the sensory experience, so that's the embodied part, and then there's the conversational part that you have. I have as the air element, which is the mental and social presence. So using language and the semiotic transmission of meaning, the literature, and also the internet, social media, all these kind of ways that we use language to communicate, and the abstractions of language and the blueprints of reality, mathematics. But then you also have the story, which I see as the water element, emotional presence, but also the film tradition and music and ways that you have consonants and dissonance cycles of building and releasing intention, but really giving this experience of time as it unfolds. And then you have the play, which I have as fire element, as active presence, so agency, video game, tradition. And so there's a lot of parallels between how you were phrasing this frontier of all these different lineages and traditions coming together and how I've come to a similar independently discovered conclusion. There.
Well, you're working with analogically thinking versus analytically. I've forced myself, going through academic, commercial, and civic, I've had to get an analytical mind to my natural artist training, which is analogical. Instinct, creativity, intuition, because no one listened to you unless you can put it into, you know, solid frameworks. And that's what I've been doing. So starting from 1995, I wrote a chapter called Theme Parks as Laboratories. for the Digital Illusion book. But since then, working with the universities, working on a piece about developing the third reality of mixed reality, the imagination or imaginality. And that was with the early days of ISMAR. And then a lot of stuff for the military and looking at different levels of engagement and interactivity, you know, the relationship between author, actor, and audience across a 3x3 matrix, but as well as looking at how do we innovate. I went to the campus in academia to figure out how can we innovate faster, easier, better. And I discovered all the reasons why we don't. And I've been working on that subject of can we get an idea to a solution faster? That's another area that I've been researching is our process for innovation. How do we do that when it takes all these disciplines? And that's even done a taxonomy of the different disciplines in the analytical disciplines with the analogical disciplines and how they're all just different sides of the same coin. I mean, like science is the truth that reveals the lie. As Picasso said, art is a lie that reveals greater truths. Both are true, both are opposite ends, as well as math and humanities, technology and media, engineering and design. And so understanding those relationships together and all at once, you know, you really start to see what I call the transdisciplinary collaboration. And then you can start working in other people's problem space. Usually innovation takes 20 years for the next generation to grow up. The way to short circuit that is to cross over different disciplines. So you start to get people thinking differently. And so when I was asked as an artist to go into a laboratory of mixed reality with trauma surgeons in Munich, it's like, how do you do that? I just did it. And other people opened to that. It was really interesting how I was able to, you know, be an artist going into a computer scientist research lab in Munich, working in polytrauma emergency room and understand where's my value. A transdisciplinary person can fit in real well. If you're stuck in your discipline, you reject it. So it was an amazing environment, which I was able to test some of the innovation process I've been exploring. So yeah, there's a lot of facets to this problem I've been chipping away at. And if you go on Google Scholar, you just put my name in down, and that's probably the only search you're going to get that Chris Stapleton doesn't come up with a Grammy.
Nice. And so maybe you just describe a little bit around what are some of the biggest open problems or questions that you're currently investigating and that's driving your work forward right now.
So AI for me is a conversation between machine and humans. And it has to be a conversation. It's not a vending machine. And then I started teaching this at the Savannah College of Art and Design to my graduate students when 2023 AI just took over. And they started using it as a vending machine. Let me get a solution. Let me put in a prompt, get a solution, prompt. And that was human input and machine output. And I said, no, we really need, I mean, the technology doesn't care about humanity. We need a human input, machine output for a human outcome. And you get the outcome by having that conversation between the analytical generative computing and the analogical human reasoning, and that conversation gets something more deep and mature and robust to get what I call the augmented imagination, which is being able, we're not there yet. And we have to define, well, what is that in that collaboration and what makes that human machine relationship and each one individually important to solving the problem?
Was there any other scholars or theorists or people who are like thinking about this that you were looking to or gaining inspiration from who are also thinking about some of these problems?
Everywhere, all the time. But it started with theme parks, working with some of the people who come from all different areas to create a theme park. And so interacting, collaborating with them. Phil Hedema, who has a nice experience design company, was my boss. And he started as a puppeteer, but did these amazing mega theme parks. And still to this day, do some really thoughtful pieces of experience. And then when I got into academia, I was following Hamlet on the Holodeck and Brenda Laurel and Computers as Theater, because it was like, wow, they were the pioneers really looking at this. And I started to see some truths in what they were saying and started piecing things together till I got to really understanding story, play, and game and how they fit together with learning. Because that whole challenge of bringing education and learning together, I can't stand the words like edutainment and gamification because it only sees one piece of that motor. And so I saw the relationship. I needed to find out what that is. And so when I got into teaching and creating digital media for UCF, started to develop the first curriculum for game design, first curriculum for interactive entertainment, the first one on, you know, designing these things. And by doing that, I got the students into real companies doing the real stuff, being near Orlando and the experiential entertainment capital of the world. Then I started to see how people thought and how they explain it to students, and then how the students picked it up. And so that intergenerational dialogue was really critical. And over the years, I've been formulating that, and they all are combined together. So I do have to do a book that puts it all together, but I've been doing it piecemeal, and the publication's on Google Scholar. So I made sure I took notes along the way. So
nice. Awesome. We'll definitely be looking at that. And so right now we seem to be in a bit of this liminal space of the XR industry where some things are ending, shutting down of layoffs and kind of closing down of different social VR platforms, and also new things are beginning. So it feels like we're kind of in this beginning of a new cycle in this liminal space where the potential seems very vast, but also very uncertain. So just curious to hear some of your thoughts of how you make sense of what's happening right now and the broader XR industry as AI is becoming a bigger and bigger part of it.
How do I make sense without the T? Okay. First of all, the entertainment industry is the worst model for innovation. It looks innovative. It looks futuristic, but it's not, because they repeat success for success. No formula for innovation. Because it changes. They don't want to change. They got something, they maximize profits, productivity. You know, they've gotten to the plateau of productivity as far as that's concerned, the hype cycle. And, you know, the whole hype cycle is a bunch of hype anyway. But, you know, the issue is we have innovation blindness. We keep on seeing the new technology in the old ways and beating it to death until it doesn't work, where it needs to bring in exponential rewards. And so, you know, with things jumping into it, I mean, it's great that Zuckerberg jumped in and bought out Oculus Rift. I was just consulting with Canon, that had the best mixed reality head mount in the market back then, which is the same as Quest 3 now, but Facebook wasn't in the industry. And I presented, I said, you know, there's only a certain amount of time that Facebook's going to buy out Oculus Rift, that they bought out Instagram, and you're going to be, your lunch is going to be eaten. And the next month, Facebook bought Oculus Rift, and then they're no longer in the head mount business. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of failures on a big scale. I've seen a lot of successes on a big scale. I've seen amazing successes on a small scale. So I've been working in all those places, synthesizing it. So right now, whenever we're just chasing money, financial capital is the last segment of that engine. And what I've discovered, particularly in the buyout of Instagram, what the model is in this century is creative capital begets social capital, which begets financial capital. Because right now, financial capital doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean, you know, it's a matter of, are you drawing that sociality? And what's drawing that is a creativity. But they're measuring it in likes, you know, they're measuring it in very empty ways. So they have innovation blindness. They don't know how to be ahead of that, so that it's up and down. It's, you know, make as much money, maximize it. My analogy is gutting the goose that lays the golden eggs. You know, you just, it, they don't lay any more eggs, and there's not any more eggs in there. You have to know how to raise geese that lay golden eggs to keep on having that flowing. And I think that this new model, we're starting to realize that is going to emerge out of the tech overlords, and that's going to see where create capital begets social capital, begets financial capital. And then, you know, you're going to have it a little bit more open process for that innovation to happen. And now that a lot of the technology is affordable, accessible, and getting into the hands of artists, relating with audiences. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, is authors' conversation with their audience, even with book writers. The issue is, right now you write a book, it goes out, and there's no more conversation, that ends it. In the reality, that needs to be an ongoing conversation. And because that conversational aspect of the story is exponentially more powerful. And also, you know, with the market, you don't make money consuming, you don't make money creating. It's the mediation of media that makes the money. But then if you insist on controlling and owning everything, that's going to peter out real quick. You're going to get your splash in the pan, and you have to have a way to feed the other geese.
Yeah, I see XR, VR, AR, as well as AI as these provocations to have a deeper paradigm shift. philosophically, there, I look to like Alfred North Whitehead and process philosophy as one way of being more relational, but also experiential, kind of grounding your own direct phenomenological experiences as primary and foundational. But there's also a paradigm shift around the economic models, because I feel like the existing models, you know, Joseph Fine just came out with his latest book, The Transformation Economy, where he was previously wrote The Experience Economy in 1999, where Pine and Gilmore really called this kind of next wave of economic value, which was experiences. So customizing commodities to goods, goods to services, services to experiences, and now customized experiences are transformational, that are unfolding over time, that are helping people live into their deepest aspirations. So I feel like that does seem right. But at the same time, the existing models that we have where you pay at the moment rather than pay for outcomes is a little bit different model than, you know, it seems like there's a lot of other deeper changes economically, like with this new technology. It feels like we are on the cusp of trying to figure out some new economic models of exchange. And I feel like Pine has identified some of those, but I feel like there's still some gaps in terms of how do we actually live into this new economic model of like, what is the next frontier for how this is all going to work and be sustained? So I feel like that's been part of the hyperscalers, let's call them, that have been coming in and trying to skip past the enterprise market and go direct to consumer and, you know, have different returns. But I feel like there's a bit of this reset that we're in right now where there might be a little bit more slower organic growth, but also different models for what success is that doesn't necessarily follow the normal rules of venture capital and having massive returns on this. So maybe we're returning to that, but just very curious to hear your take on that in terms of like the paradigm shifts that we need and if there's other economic models that you think would potentially be a good fit for how some of these more experiential modes or transformational modes of entertainment may be sustained.
Yeah, about Joe Pine's work is I'm a big fan of, and I started using his experience economy as a text in my teaching 26 years ago. But I realized that a lot of researchers who innovate innovation aren't necessarily doing innovation. So they're not in the middle of it. And so to be able to see beyond the new ways to use the new technology, researchers use precedent. And precedent doesn't really predict the future. And so I was worked on an innovation matrix that I was able to kind of look at, well, if it works, it should have be able to roadmap Edison's projector, you know, because that was an innovation, but he invented it, but he didn't innovate it. And there's a difference. We're all innovators. We're all inventors, but we're rarely innovators of our own invention. Because then I saw Steve Jobs, you know, his big thing was graphics interfaces. And that's when I got into computers. And he started to, you know, innovate the mouse that was invented 20 years ago. And then I realized there's this 20-year gap between invention and innovation. Can't that grow smaller? And so that's where I started to see where the next generation looks at things differently. So how to make that time span shorter, you have to look at different disciplines than different generation, preferably both. But then I started with the innovation matrix track, you know, okay, NASA and the Army's technology readiness levels, you have 9 sections, you know, how does that work? And how does that relate with Edison and then relate with Steve Jobs to be able to kind of find this other mechanics that can be repeatable, even though the technology is completely different. And I came by with a 3x3 matrix and started to map out all these so I can then start to plan, well, what is that convention from now? And so it's 3 levels. The first level is the product itself. Like with Steve Jobs, it was the iPod. How do I make it smaller, slick, and fit in your pocket, not a Walkman? And then it's a product experience, which relates to Joe Pine's work. And then I say, well, that's a whole nother level of innovation that has to start from the beginning to go through the ideation, invention, and innovation process. But then what I realize also, and this is, I can track it with all these industries, is not what you make and how you make it, but how you make money from it. And that's the third level. And that's the product to market. And you have to work with the ideation and invention stages on all of those before you even start the first innovation. That's what Steve Jobs does. He borrowed from all those invention and ideation pieces to then do the last stage of innovation. So the iPod was the innovation of the product. The design of the apps were to be able to do adjust to experiences was the product experience. And then the last part of the innovation was iTunes that changed the way we make money from it. And that happens with everything. And people expect 10 times the return on innovation for the cost of change or the promise. And so that's where I've been able to map it all along and then apply it to my own research, helping different companies know how to innovate. Whether they listen or not, that's a whole different issue. Because one of the things I found out, because I usually, with theme parks, you innovate as you go. And so you have to do what never has been done before on a schedule. But if they don't listen, you know, what do? And you take notes, you add it to your model, and hopefully, you know, and so, you know, predicting a lot of these companies that have made hundreds and millions and billions of investment all to lose it in a marketplace, they're so good at burying those mistakes that we never learned from them. And so that is our inability for entertainment to you know, for theme parks, is they don't self-critique. That's a big problem. In entertainment, they don't like to change, you know, even if it did. And then they're just trying to, you know, so there's so many parts of this problem that just isn't the story realm. But then I learned so much from the other applications that when we go into our next phase of reconstruction after our current disruption, things are going to change because innovation is driven by crisis. And I thought COVID was the crisis, but I think we're in a bigger crisis that's going to push and stimulate innovation even more and make it critical.
Nice. And then finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of all this may be, and especially reflecting on your own intentions for what you would like to see in terms of like where this all could go, where you want it to go, what you would like to see? So just curious to hear a bit of your reflections of kind of tapping in your own creative imagination for what would you like to see where this all goes?
Well, I want to experience my dreams in a conscious state of mind, like my lucid dreaming as a kid. But we'll never get anywhere close if we can't cure innovation blindness, which is everywhere all the time. But I think that there's something about AI, which I think the most important aspect of it, it removes ignorance as an obstacle. We can start asking questions that we have no business asking, which I would do in transdisciplinary research, but then get a respectful, in-depth answer. Whether it's right or wrong, I have to do more research to verify it. But the whole ideation, invention, innovation process is ideation is recognize opportunity. Invention is validating opportunity, and innovation is capturing innovation. We have to work with a systematic way that we can work together without being threatened or being greedy. That's a big ask. But all I want to do is see my dreams in a conscious state of mind. So is that too much to ask for?
I think we'll get there maybe eventually, some point. I don't know when, but yeah, we're moving towards that. Anything else left unsaid you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Yeah, because I'm growing older and all my stuff is getting more and bigger, I believe in order to really find that creative loop and that iteration loop, small is the new big. And we're going to find that in smaller communities, smaller developers, smaller area. And historically, small businesses does most all of the radical innovation, and the corporations do more of the sustaining innovations, meaning that how do I make this more efficient, better? The radical innovation that smaller operators do, they change the way we do business. But you can't change the way you do business and the way you make media and the technology. You have to look at it as a whole. And that's where these conferences really are helpful, to bring all these different minds together on the same goal or same problem.
Awesome. Well, Christopher, it was great to be able to sit down with you and hear a bit of your reflections on the industry, some of your thoughts and your frameworks and your deep work of a long time of fusing all these different disciplines together. So yeah, I look forward to digging into more of it and unpacking it more. And yeah, but it was a real pleasure to be able to get a chance to sit down and talk more. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast.
Come to my talk on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Love your feedback.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast and for keeping the faith for where this industry is going here in the future. I feel like this is a kind of a weird time for everybody in the industry. And if you believe in where this technology may go and that it may be able to bring about positive social change and transformation in the world, then please do consider supporting me here at the Voices of VR podcast, trying to navigate these dimensions of transformation and positive change for where all this might be going. So if you enjoy the coverage that I'm doing here, then please do consider becoming a member at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.